Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and The Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rothwell. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment, and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction, and welcome to The Sync Report.
Well, welcome to The Sync Report. Let's welcome our producer extraordinaire, the one and only Paula Flack. Paula, how are you?
I'm good, thanks, Colin. How are you? I see you've been playing golf this week.
I've been playing a little bit of golf. I've been getting out swinging the clubs. What
how
about
is
you?
Your swing? Well, how's your swing, first of all?
Well, my swing is, it's getting there. It's getting there. It's good. It's good.
I can hit it about,
you know, 260, 270 maybe on a good day.
That sounds like a lot.
Isn't that horrible? I think that's really bad.
It's pretty good.
Oh, is that
good.
How many
Thanks.
Yards? Because I can do a 72, when people play, that's the numbers are much lower. You're talking about how far the ball's going.
I was talking about yards, Jason. Don't get involved in this section.
You are atrocious, right? Colin.
This is not for you to get involved with. All right.
I've been playing a bit of golf myself, actually.
Have you indeed? How's your swing?
My swing's good. I'm about, well, I couldn't tell you how far, but I can tell you that my total for the round was about 20.
How was that, Jason? Is that good? Can you tell us, please?
I can tell you. If she's out there on, you know, doing 18 holes and got a 20, I don't know how that's possible.
I got myself caught in the bunker a couple of times, and then the dinosaur squirted me with water, but it was fine.
Wait.
I love a bit of crazy
golf.
Hold
on a sec. Wait.
Oh.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, there you go. That explains it.
I'm going to step in. All of that. I think it's great. Congratulations. That's good.
I was talking about grown-up golf. You know,
real golf.
Grown-up golf. Real golf.
I know, real golf. How far do you walk when you play 18 holes?
I think the last time I played 18 was nearly 12 kilometers. Oh. I'm not sure what that is in miles for people.
That's
in miles.
A lot.
I think that's probably, but what's that, about 9 miles maybe?
Yeah,
this is where the episode is beginning to get boring. So, let's move on. It was funny because Jason decided to get himself involved in our friendly banter.
Hey, this is what happens when you guys come up with ideas and don't pass it by Kevin and I. We don't know what to be doing.
Right. Okay. Well, on that note, Paula, who have we got in the show this week?
We have Alex Stern on the show this week, Colin. Alex Stern is a music supervisor, an artist, producer, writer, and DJ from Chicago. Possibly our first guest from Chicago, in fact. Starting his career as a composer for ads, he switched to music supervision whilst at the global ad agency Leo Burnett, which grew into one of the biggest and most successful agency music teams in the country.
Yeah.
At the age of 26, he launched a new music department at two agencies simultaneously, DDB Worldwide and their McDonald's-focused sister agency, We Are Unlimited. Alex's work has won countless awards, including a coveted Cannes Lion Grand Prix, a Grand Clio, and an Emmy for Outstanding Commercial. He was responsible for the first ever licensed use of a Prince recording in an advert. Ooh. Produced a full-blown Broadway musical for Skittles on Super Bowl Sunday, nabbed a first-ever Guild of Music Supervisors nomination for a beer brand, as well as a win for Best Original Score at the Music and Sound Awards. As director of music at DDB, Alec worked on campaigns for world-renowned brands including Jeep, Capital One, the U.S. Army, Miller Lite, and State Farm. Recently, Alec teamed up with music supervision company Radish Music to continue finding innovative ways for music to be an integral piece in the way artists, brands, and storytellers communicate and interact with the world.
So needed.
Aside from his work as a music supervisor, Alec is an accomplished artist and producer whose collaborations have been featured by the likes of Billboard, Complex, and Lyrical Lemonade. He's a member of the Recording Academy and is deeply passionate about mentoring young artists. His writing has been featured by publications such as Fakeshore Drive, Ruby Hornet, Pop Matters, and Muse by Cleo, as well as in the print edition of Best Damn Hip Hop Writing 2018.
Wicked.
He is also a frequent DJ performing under the moniker DJ Young Health. He's a vocal advocate for social and racial justice, as well as a founding board member of the Pam Stern Legacy of Hope, which has so far raised over $100,000 for special needs families and teachers. Please welcome Alec Stern.
Hey there. Welcome. How are you guys?
Welcome to the Sync Report, Alex. Thanks for joining us.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you, guys.
Well, I can't wait to delve into your impressive career. I was wondering if being a musician, a stroke composer, was always on the cards for you, Alec, or do you have any defining moments with exposure to music that sort of turned you on to being a musician?
It's the sort of thing where I was very fortunate in that when music entered my life, it was one of those things where up until that point, I really didn't have any idea of sort of what my calling was, where I sort of fit in the world or anything like that. But then as soon as music really sort of came into my life, from that point, it was just this lightning bolt moment where I knew that that was, you know, everything that I wanted to do, you know, in my life. It was who I wanted to, you know, surround myself with in terms of interests and, you know, like-minded just thoughts and all those sorts of things. And ideally, you know, that would be what I would make a living doing one day. And so, you know, it was the sort of thing where music was always around growing up. Really, one of my earliest memories has music as a really pivotal kind of point to it. Music was really always playing in my dad's car. He had a cool, you know, convertible, and he was one of those guys who always had the top down, sort of no matter what the weather was. And so hearing, you know, classic rock music playing from his stereo with the top down, driving down, you know, city streets and things like that, just left a huge, huge impression for me at a young age. And I have a really specific memory of listening to The Who's We Won't Get Fooled Again on full blast, full volume, top down, windows down. And we were we were heading somewhere and had somewhere to be. But my dad just would not let us get out of the car until we heard the entirety of the song at full volume, you know, all the solos and everything. It was a pretty remarkable experience. And just, that was a moment for me where I could just sort of feel how expansive and resonant, you know, music really could be and how powerful of a connecting force it could be.
I love that where you were going and all that kind of stuff doesn't matter. All you can remember is the song.
Exactly.
Which is good, because we actually have a clip of I Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who now, if you want to hear it.
Love it.
Yes, yes, yes.
Spin him, Alfredo.
I love that track, but you know what? As I'm listening to it, the only thing I can think about is NTIS or whatever that NCIS, you know, that TV show that uses it for the open. I just had to say that.
I think it was, I think you'll find it was CSI.
That's it. CSI. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I noticed that he said you got to pick up your guitar and play. So
yes.
was that sort of what got you into playing the guitar? Was it, you know, listen to The Who and probably various other similar classic rock bands, I guess.
Yeah, it was. So it was the sort of thing. I have that memory. I was, I don't know, maybe 7, 8 years old, somewhere around there. And it was the sort of thing where music was something that really interested me, but it never really quite felt like it was something that could be mine. And, you know, you have to fast forward a couple of years for sort of that light switch to really go off. And there's sort of two really sort of pivotal moments that I kind of link to that. The first is the first time a guitar was actually put in my hands. It was the sort of thing, I was at a sleepover at a friend's house. And at some point during the night, you know, a couple doors down, his older sister was actually learning to play the guitar. She had a proficient guitar playing friend over, and he was teaching her some chords, and they were just sort of messing around. And I must have just been drawn by the sound of it, and wandered over there. And I think they saw, you know, me just sort of standing in the hallway, and it was sort of like, hey dude, want me to teach you some chords? And I just, you know, sat there and had this guitar in my hands. And I learned that night, I learned Secret Agent Man was the first tune. And then I learned Satisfaction by the Stones. And just playing them over and over again and not minding, you know, that my fingers hurt, you know, pushing the strings down and really feeling just such a rush of excitement and just this great unlocking moment. You know, I got picked up by my mom the following morning. And I think the first thing, you know, out of my mouth was, can we go to the guitar store? You know, I found my thing. Can you believe it? And, you know, I think as somebody up to that point, I say it somewhat jokingly, but, you know, the first like 12-ish years of my life, I kind of considered to be this like giant identity crisis. And all of that instantly fades away as soon as I pick up the guitar for the first time. And then, you know, so that's where the idea of being a music creator kind of enters my life. And sort of the other side of the coin is, you know, being a true music fan, a beloved, you know, a lover of music listening and, you know, writing, and it becoming such a huge part of my life. And that actually stems from the first time I heard Nirvana. I grew up in, you know, sort of like a post Kurt Cobain world. He just was not really part in any way of my lexicon or, you know, what was sort of being played, you know, around me at the time. And a friend of mine who I was actually learning to play guitar with at one point during school, he put a book on my desk and said, you have to read this. And it was Heavier Than Heaven by Charles R. Cross, which is like the definitive Kurt Cobain biography. And I had no idea who this person was. And I started reading it and I was captivated by this story of this guy. And I noticed I kept reading these words over and over again. And those words were, smells like teen spirit, smells like teen spirit. And thinking to myself, like, what is this thing? I don't know what this is that keeps getting brought up in such huge, huge light. And so I rode my bike to the library, found the first CD that I could find with Nirvana on the cover, which happened to be their greatest hits record, and came home and put it on my Walkman and put my headphones on and hit play. And within 10 seconds of the first tune, I just had this reckoning moment where I was like, I've never heard anything like this before. This is not being played on the radio around me. This is not in my dad's car. I love this. No. I feel so connected to this. And it was this great eye-opening experience where it was like, oh my God, music can be mine. It can be my thing where I can find my own path. I can find my own means of expression through the music that I find. And I can build relationships with people based upon that. And really those two moments are, you know, some of the most pivotal of my entire life. And everything that I've done, you know, certainly in my career, but in so many ways in my life, really stems from those couple moments.
Well, we actually have a clip of Nirvana as well.
Ah, let's do it. I haven't heard this in a long time, so I'm psyched.
We've got a clip of You Know You're Right. So let's take a listen to this. Spin It, Manfredo.
I will never bother you.
Oh, brings back good memories, doesn't it?
It's so thrilling. God, it's so dark. It's so heavy, but I find it so beautiful and cathartic. And I have such, just now, I had just such a rush back to being 12 years old, sitting cross-legged on my floor with headphones on and just seeing an entirely new world open up in front of me. So,
it's funny. I got transported back to being a teenager as well. And I've just suddenly realized, growing up as a massive Pearl Jam fan, I can actually like Nirvana. And I've only just realized that.
Right. Same thing. I couldn't listen to Pearl Jam until my early 20s because I was just brainwashed into thinking you had to choose or the other. It was such a brutal mistake.
Ugh. See, I'm a whore. I was like Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains. I'll take
it was fine for me to listen to Alice in Chains and all that kind of stuff too, you know, but in Soundgarden. But it was, I don't know, it was one of those things that it was like the... It's kind of like the Blur Oasis sort of thing that people
pick
just
your team,
sort of created,
pick your team, you know, pick your squad. Team. I get it. I was the same. So funny.
Well, you guys picked well, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I still stand by my choice.
So you got a guitar in the end. Mm-hmm. And what was your first guitar? And were you more acoustic or were you electric, or which was it for you?
Yeah, probably won't be too much of a surprise based on those first two songs that we played. Electric guitar was definitely the thing. I own an acoustic guitar. I've never been super intrigued by the sound or feel of that instrument so much. I'm also never been as interested in sort of like really sort of traditional songcraft that would come from an acoustic guitar. I'm really huge into things that feel really sonically expansive and experimental and are led sort of in that sense versus sort of traditional singer-songwriting craft. So the electric guitar has always been my instrument of choice. And as the years have gone on and I've developed such a relationship with that instrument, so much of, you know, what I've always attempted to do is to find ways to play it in ways that don't necessarily sound like an electric guitar. And, you know, I consider a lot of the music that I've made over my life, and I've been in, you know, multiple bands and things like that. And I've always sort of been the lead guitarist, and I've always sort of seen my job is to add, you know, interesting sonic textures. And, you know, if a song is sort of this thing, you know, drawn sort of in black and white, my job is to add all the color to it. And so I find the electric guitar to be a really, really exciting tool to get sort of those sonic textures out.
Listen, you're talking to somebody who has more guitars than he knows what to do with, so I know what you mean. But
I hear you. I've always actually, I literally only own two guitars, which is the weirdest thing. I own an electric and I own an acoustic. And as I've grown older, I've certainly had the ability to own a bunch of guitars, but there is, I'm one of those people where it's like,
you're a loyal guy, Alec.
I know what I like, and I have these two that I know like a body part.
Yeah.
And they've traveled so much of the country and the world with me, and they're like little family members at this point.
So do you think that your style and the way that you played the lead and the sonic, you know, creating the sonic textures and stuff when you were in the bands, do you think it was a natural progression and for you to transition from a player in bands to composing original?
Yeah. So I had always been that lead player. And I love the feeling and all that goes into, you know, improvisation and, you know, all those sorts of things. So lead guitar had always been sort of my place. You know, it was interesting. I was in college and I had gone through a pretty significant personal tragedy, and I was seeing a psychiatrist. And at some point, relatively early on into our relationship, he asked me the question of, you know, we were still sort of getting to know each other a little bit. And he asked, is there anything that you used to like to do, something that used to bring you joy that you just aren't really gravitating toward, you know, in, you know, sort of your more depressed kind of state of mind as of late? And, you know, I said, well, I used to, you know, play music all the time. I used to play guitar in bands and do all of that. And I haven't been able to pick up the instrument, you know, in a while. He asked me, have you ever written any of your own songs? And I, you know, let him know, you know, not really. I've always, you know, helped shape other people's songs, but I've never actually sat down and written one of my own. And he said, all right, well, we can stop seeing each other now. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, go home and write a fucking song, because that's going to do more for you than I can ever do.
What's this guy's name and number?
For real. It was beautiful advice. And I'm so indebted to him for that. It turned out it was exactly what I needed. You know, creating pieces of music became such a remarkable form of therapy and creative expression for me. You know, what was interesting was, at the beginning of sort of my songwriting career, it was pure expression, you know, needing to get things off my chest. So it was, you know, relatively simplistic in terms of kind of being a singer-songwriter approach. And as my career as a musician and composer has evolved, it's really been trying to implement more of, you know, what comes naturally to me, what are ways to actually express, you know, who I am as an individual, sort of my unique qualities, my unique sort of take on the world, my unique sensibilities and things like that, and really utilize them in music. And so my own sort of art has very much sort of evolved from, you know, more traditional singer-songwriter kind of stuff to more sort of emotive, ambient, ethereal, kind of cinematic, world-building kind of works. And so, you know, I've certainly grown and evolved as a musician, as a producer, and that's sort of lent itself into the idea of composing, and flexing sort of my musical imagination that way.
So, Alec, this is Rose. Nice to have you on the show.
For sure.
So you finished college. What were you studying in college, by the way?
So I was a media studies major with a psychology minor.
In Chicago?
University of Illinois. Yes. So just a couple hours south of Chicago.
Right. Got it. So at this point, you're in your early 20s. You're finishing up college. What was your next step in forming your current career? How did you go from writing music to working in one of the most reputable ad sync companies in the United States?
It was the sort of thing where I knew that I wanted music to be what I was going to hopefully do with my life and my career. But it was the sort of thing where the avenues of what, you know, sort of the music industry, particularly in the Midwest and Chicago, looked like, it wasn't necessarily as apparent, you know, all those years ago as it is now. And so it was the sort of thing where I definitely wanted to at least try to stay in Chicago if I could, but, you know, I wasn't seeing a whole lot of, you know, apparent industry in Chicago. The music industry is very obvious, you know, in LA, it's very obvious in New York. And, you know, I would argue it has sort of its own kind of art, you know, obvious space in places like Nashville and things like that. Mm-hmm. Chicago, it wasn't as easy to sort of detect how to, you know, make a living doing music. Mm-hmm. And so I tried a number of different things. I interned at a few, you know, live event spaces and things like that while I was in college. And then it was purely actually by happenstance. I ended up hearing from somebody I went to high school with. I ended up hearing about a company called Comma Music, which is what's called an original music company. And that's a company that has generally a staff of composers who write music for visual media. In this case, it was commercials. And I happened to hear about this from, again, somebody I went to high school with, and it was literally just, you know, she came up to me and was like, you were always Mr. Music Guy in high school. Is that still what you're interested in? And if so, I heard about this place and thought that you might be a good fit for it. And that was really my introduction to this whole world. Being around composers and sound engineers and producers and things like that. And, you know, their client base was ad agencies, right. Particularly, you know, Chicago and Midwest based agencies.
Yeah.
And so it was through that experience that I sort of got to understand, you know, what the advertising agency looks like, you know, both from the inside and the outside, and who, you know, all the players are, and chain of command and how, you know, an ad gets made and where music sort of fits within that.
Right.
And so that was an amazing experience. I was a production intern and ended up sort of squeezing my way into, you know, doing some freelance composition work for them, which was such a delight. And, you know, through that, I ended up, you know, building some relationships with different agencies. And I ended up getting into contact with an agency in Chicago called Leo Burnett.
Leo Burnett.
Who are it's a massive, massive, you know, ad agency. And they have some of the biggest clients in the world. And they had just hired their first in-house music department very recently. And I ended up meeting with those guys who were spearheading the department and was just in awe of the kind of work that they were doing. I thought it was so incredible and it was matching, you know, my love for recordings and songs and weaving them into stories and into picture.
Yeah.
And I was thrilled by just the idea of it. And I was essentially like, teach me, I'll do this for free. I'll come here whenever. Like, I just want to learn how to do what you guys do. And I think that they were, you know, intrigued by maybe my composer background, that, you know, maybe I could spearhead some of the original music kind of scoring projects. And
but also at that period of time, the ad agencies were not looking at, you know, bands and, you know, famous pieces of music, but rather original compositions and jingles and things like that, right? So you were right on the cusp when people started realizing that you could also place, you know, bigger or more well-known music in commercials.
Yes.
Because people were seeing that could lead to some real serious cash. Before then, the bands thought that was selling out, but that's not what happened. Give us a little context there.
Yeah. I love this question. And I very much grew up in that world of, you know, major brands associating with, you know, with artists and things like that was a totally taboo subject. And it wasn't something that was, you know, very encouraged in culture and things like that. And, you know, this isn't necessarily music related, but it's funny. Growing up, my family would always gather to watch TV together. And I was always too busy, you know, playing guitar or listening to records alone in my room. So it'd be, you know, the whole family watching TV in one room and me being alone with headphones on generally in my own room. And, you know, this was back when, you know, there wasn't, you know, streaming or TiVo or DVR or anything like that, when you needed to watch commercials, you know, during your favorite shows. And this was, I would say, you know, before advertising really became sort of the artful storytelling, you know, thing that it is today. And anytime a particularly, you know, offensively not funny or not clever or whatever commercial would come on, my entire family in unison would yell my name. And what they meant by that was like, you're the only creative person in this house. You're the only creative person that we know. Like, would you do something about this? Would you make these better? Because we have to just sit through these and suffer through them. And it's so strange that I ended up being in this industry and doing my part to make them better through the lens of music. And
right.
What was so exciting, you know, as I was starting, because I had the exact same sort of mentality as you mentioned, that, you know, major bands and artists didn't really have any reason to associate with brands. But I was learning more about, you know, the changing industry, and as things were shifting rapidly in terms of exposure and how artists made or didn't make money, or, you know, things like that. The whole notion of licensing and creative partnerships with brands was all of a sudden becoming much more lucrative and much more, you know, applicable and exciting for artists. And I joined the industry at what I think was a really interesting time, because from my perspective, as artists, you know, were beginning to come to the table to allow, you know, their music or their name and likeness to be associated with brands, I think that required advertising in general to become much more artful, to become much more tasteful in order to be worthy of, you know, some of these major songs being part of what they were doing. And so I think that you started to see this rising sea tide, you know, artists coming to the table, being interested, advertising agencies and clients needing to become much more artful in their approach. Yeah. And so as the ads got better, more and more artists started to be like, oh, wow, this is actually like, you know, you're seeing Academy Award winning directors and cinematographers making ads. Yeah. Now, I want to be a part of that. And understanding the exposure and, you know, so many commercials from that period were giving brands, or sorry, we're giving artists major, major career bumps. And
we have some major, we have some major directors who started in the commercial world, or, and, you know, people like Ridley Scott, that's a famous story about the early commercials that he did, which were so absolutely cinematic. And then Baz Luhrmann and, you know, people like that who got involved and it became really special. But I remember when Michael Jackson surreptitiously bought the rights to the Beatles catalog, and the first time a Beatles song was used in a commercial, there was collective shock, shockwaves across the music industry on, oh my God, they're selling out, and, you know, this kind of thing. But, you know, that eventually became acceptable and, you know, it went from there.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was a really exciting time to be joining this field and just feeling like we were sort of paving the way for, you know, an exciting new reality, you know, where artists who, you know, were brand new or legacy artists could, you know, align themselves with something really interesting and hopefully really tasteful and, you know, provide them, you know, exposure to an entirely new audience or demographic or whatever it was. Right. And also, you know, this was a very important, necessary revenue stream in a very, very, you know, changing time where artists and labels and publishers and everyone involved were kind of wondering, how are we going to survive with all of this changing technology and industry where people are not spending $19.99 buying a compact disc at Best Buy anymore or whatever it is. And all of a sudden, you know, this became this new avenue where artists could, you know, stay afloat and continue their careers in exciting new ways. And so to be a part of that has always been, you know, the most interesting and exciting aspect for me. And it's something that I try to remind myself of, you know, for any project that I'm doing.
Alec, can you just name some of the brands that were pioneers in making this transition into more popular music relating to ads and telling stories in a different way musically?
Yeah. I mean, everyone, I think, rightfully points to Apple being a huge, you know, change maker in that space. Just some of the most tasteful, artistic, and certainly music-driven work in ads that really has come out of, you know, our culture over the last couple of decades, you know. And so they have always been some, you know, a brand that I have looked at as, you know, being indebted in terms of huge, huge respect in terms of music choices and things like that. And I'm especially beyond excited to now be at a venture where I am working with the global director of music who worked on quite a bit of those great Apple ads in my new space at Radish. And other than that, you know, I have been really fortunate to, you know, personally have worked with a bunch of brands that I think have done some really incredible work. I was lucky enough to work with Samsung for a number of years, who were really pushing boundaries. And, you know, for one of my earliest experiences in this industry, you know, my team and I, we were the first, and I believe to this day, only ones to license the song Royals by Lorde.
Oh, great.
And we were able to nab that, you know, in the weeks actually before she hit number one on the charts. And so that was this really kind of incredible moment where we were seeing, you know, the work that we were doing really interacting with culture in a really significant way. you know, and even brands like, you know, Jeep has always, you know, Jeep has been really forward leaning in terms of music, and I've loved working with them. And, you know, I've gotten really lucky over my career, to have worked with a bunch, and even, I know you mentioned it in the bio, but, you know,
don't say it. This is my question. Rose is such a great interviewer. She's pulling information out of your future questions.
All right.
Well, so I'm jumping in now, Rose, because I'm ready to ask this question. Oh, God, what a conversation. This is just so great, Alec. Thank you. You moved from Leo Burnett to DDB, which I'm curious how that move came. But really, as you were just about to allude to, Paula mentioned you did this incredible sync, something that nobody had ever done before you. No music supervisor, no huge director, no massive studio. No, you, for an ad, booked Prince. Unbelievable. I mean, can you please tell us the story behind this? It's mind-blowing.
So yeah, my transition over to DDB and their sister agency, We Are Unlimited, it was this really kind of amazing moment where, you know, I was, you know, becoming a larger part of sort of the Leo Burnett, you know, machine, and our team was doing some really significant and award-winning and sort of culture-moving work. And it was this really beautiful time where I think that a lot of agencies were starting to see things like that and going, man, like, whatever they're doing, you know, is they're crushing it. Oh, it turns out that they have an in-house music department. We should get one of those and really invest in music as part of our offering to our clients in a more substantial way. And I was really fortunate that was something that DDB was interested in doing. DDB is one of the other really, really big agencies based out of Chicago. They were in the process of trying to win a couple massive pieces of business. One was the US Army account and one was the Miller Lite account. And I think at a certain point during the pitching process for both of those brands, you know, agency leadership just sort of looked at the work that was being presented, and so much of it, unintentionally or not, was music driven. It had music as key element of the identity of the work, you know, because that's ultimately the way to engage with culture right now is through great music and having a strong music
point of
view. It
is culture. It's a piece. Exactly. That's how you connect. Yeah,
exactly. And so I was thrilled to receive a call from DDB that they had that realization and that they had the understanding that if they were going to, you know, win these pieces of business and really advance the agency to being, you know, a global powerhouse agency, you know, they'd be crazy to try and do that if they didn't have, you know, music as a part of their agency offering and have somebody with music in their title who could speak to those sorts of things. And so I was very fortunate to be the one to get that call. And I think they were like, hey, so this is not even just for DDB, it's for another agency. So if you, you know, young, hungry 26-year-old would be, you know, interested/stupid, crazy enough to take on the job of being director of music for not just one, but two agencies who aren't even located in the same building, you know, we'd love to offer that to you. And so that was a real sort of significant step forward in my career. And it was very exciting. And It was a great opportunity to take the things that I had learned and sort of my point of view and approach to things and to bring them somewhere new where they hadn't had a music presence previously. And, you know, it was the sort of thing where I think by virtue of having me in the building, you know, as my time there increased, you know, I started to notice more of the work that we were presenting and more of the work that clients were signing off on. It started to be more music focused. It started to have music as part of the creative DNA of what we were presenting, you know? And so within, you know, 2 years of me being there, we were pitching things like having Skittles put on, you know, a Broadway musical on for the Super Bowl.
Right. Oh, no, we're going to talk all about that later. Oh, my God. Brilliant. Brilliant.
And so, you know, things like that. And, you know, and so that was such a joy to be within the building as those music driven ideas were being presented. And, you know, for the Prince thing, it was so funny. So Capital One, who was a longstanding client of the agency, they were wanting to put out a campaign for a very significant new offering, a new card of theirs. And they really wanted to go all out in terms of the campaign. And the brief that I received, as I remember it, was that they essentially said, we want to go places with music that no other brand can touch. And literally as a joke, because I thought there is no conceivable way that this could actually happen, the first words out of my mouth when getting the brief were, all right, let's go with Prince, let's go crazy. And to my complete shock,
oh, yeah,
they were like,
why not? You know, that right, little right. track.
That little one, right, exactly. And to my total shock, they were like, that's exactly the kind of thing we're thinking. More of that, please. It was, you know, it was this very, very strange situation where I am pitching what I consider to be sort of like the Mount Rushmore of artists, you know, to this brand, and you know, not like B-sides or unknown songs from these artists, but some of their biggest hits. And, you know, as the process is progressing, you know, we're sticking to a lot of these major, major tracks. And the whole time, as weeks go on, as I'm collecting, you know, massively expensive quotes, as it's getting into edit, all those sorts of things, I keep thinking to myself, all right, so when are you going to have me actually do a search for something that, you know, you're going to actually want to spend the money on and actually be able to afford? And I still kept thinking that that was going to happen until essentially the day that the campaign aired, when it was like, oh my God, we're actually moving forward with Prince Let's Go Crazy as the campaign launch spot. And I believe it aired on maybe the Emmys or Golden Globes or some massive televised event.
Of course. So, I mean, you get something, you get royalty in an ad, you know, it has to go large. Amazing.
Yeah. And it was this remarkable moment. So it was a three spot campaign. The three songs that we ended up going with, it was like the holy trifecta. It was Prince's Let's Go Crazy, was Michael Jackson's Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, and Whitney Houston's I Want to Dance with Somebody. Like,
God almighty.
Like the greatest,
God, the holy trinity
in the world. And yeah. To be a part of something that massive, to have any sort of association with artists of that stature and of songs of that stature, it was a really remarkable moment. And that was a real moment where, at least to me, it signaled the shift of, as you know, as we were talking about earlier, of, you know, the old days of, you know,
selling out versus selling in.
Exactly. You know, those things had just sort of fundamentally shifted, and this was sort of the new reality that we were living in. And so to have been a part of something like that, where you could really feel the ground sort of shifting in this new direction and sort of opening the gates for, you know, what the next incarnation of what the industry was going to be and how it associates with music, that was a real honor.
Alec, was everybody paid? Was it favored nations? Everybody got the same amount of money for each of those songs?
No, they were totally different creative. They were all, you know, individual quotes for all three. So it wasn't the same fee across all three.
Oh my God.
This is amazing. And really, it makes me think of something that Rose just mentioned. One of my favorite directors is Ridley Scott. And she also mentioned Baz Luhrmann. This felt like a shift in time with advertising that leaned more towards storytelling instead of just pushing the product down people's throats. You know, you see so many spots and actually so many campaigns that move towards telling a story. Do you think that that had anything to do with the shift in terms of, you know, big music being involved?
Yeah, you know, I have always considered my role, you know, it's one thing that I talk about and think about a lot is that we are dealing, you know, with when we're talking about an ad, you're really dealing with two senses only. You're dealing with what you can see and what you can hear. You know, the other senses generally don't really apply when it comes to an ad. And, you know, what you can see is the story, the characters on screen, what they're doing. It's all of the information. And that information includes the brand, the brand's logo, you know, what their product is, all those sorts of things. And so there's all this emphasis on information and what you can see. My job is the other part of that, which is how do you feel about what you're seeing? What is the feeling associated with the story being told, with the, you know, product that is being put in front of you? And certainly, what is your feeling toward the brand that's behind all of it? And so a huge part of my job that I see it is pushing that part, you know, making the two senses be on more sort of equal footing, where it's not such an emphasis on one and there isn't so much emphasis on the other. Because I think without the feeling, you're left with something that just doesn't quite communicate the way that I think we're all hoping and wanting for it to. And so I've been thrilled that within my career, I have seen what I consider to be a really, really strong emphasis on sound and with that in terms of feeling. And I think that everybody is really excited and interested in creating works that make you feel something. And the best way to do that is to tell an engaging story. And if you can tell an engaging story and utilize music or sound in a way that activates, you know, a real sort of human feeling, a human connection, you know, and sometimes that's using a really strong, ultra recognizable piece of music that, you know, we all have a positive association with, and therefore that positive association gets linked to whatever it is that you're seeing. Sometimes it's, you know, using a piece of music that feels completely foreign and completely new and exciting and makes you want to engage in that way. And other times it's just music that just in some way elevates the story and elevates, you know, what the storyteller is trying to communicate. And I think that, you know, as these wonderful directors and writers and as they become more engaged in our art form, I think that we're all trying to do the same thing here, which is to make a mark and to connect and to, you know, leave people moved in one way or another. And so I'm, you know, thrilled to be a part of that in any way that I can. And my way to do that has always been through music. And so pushing for that to be, you know, as effective and engaging as it can possibly be, that's always going to, you know, be my job description number one.
So yeah, thank you, Kevin, for jumping in there. I got to just say the size of your bean bags, my God. Alec, the bravery, and maybe it was because you're young and naive, but the fact that you were able to go in and make these huge things happen, which really, it started an avalanche within the industry. It opened up people's thinking. Mm. It changed the way songwriters and artists felt about commercializing their music. And like you pointed out, at this point in time, the digital age had all but wrecked the earning potential for artists. Opening these doors was just monumental. And I think the only way to celebrate you and this amazing achievement is by playing a clip from Prince.
Let's do it.
Let's hear a bit of Let's Go Crazy. I'm dancing
anything better? Oh, my God.
Love it.
So, Alec, years ago, I worked with the Mars Company on the launch of Vinny M&M's, and you worked with the Skittles brand, which is another Mars brand, on a very unique campaign, which was actually a Broadway show for the Super Bowl. And I want you to give us the background and what it actually was, what it entailed, putting all of this together, and what the end result was, how it went out. How did they roll it out?
Yeah. Yeah, that may be the project of my career that I look on most fondly, just because it was such a, frankly, batshit crazy concept that we somehow pulled off, and people responded to it in ways that we could have really never imagined. So it was the sort of thing, it's become, you know, very in vogue sort of these days, the idea of sort of hijacking the Super Bowl. To get a commercial play during the actual game is remarkably astronomically expensive. Just to get the ad time is several million dollars for 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And so, you know, brands have started to come up with this idea of how do we become part of the Super Bowl conversation without actually being a part of the game and spending all the money just to get the time. And so Skittles was a brand who was very, very interested in that concept. And the year prior to the Broadway show, we had done a project for them called The Most Exclusive Ad of All Time, where we created this full-fledged commercial. It was, you know, impeccably put together and produced and shot. It starred David Schwimmer, and it was this whole thing. And the concept was, we've created this Super Bowl commercial that we are only going to show to one human being one time during the Super Bowl, and then it is destroyed and never to be seen again. And it picked up all of this amazing press and became this really sort of beloved gem of the Super Bowl in terms of just what brands could do. And so as we were briefed for the following year, basically the idea was, you know, can we do something like what we did last year, but maybe ideally a few more people than just one person could see it. And so I think the idea really sort of stemmed, such a funny kind of strategic approach, but the idea really, I think, stemmed from the fact that when you go to a high-end Broadway show, you go to the concession stand and everything there is like, you know, a pack of Skittles, for example, would be like $15.
Yeah, at least.
Versus if you go down the street to, you know, a bodega, it's, you know, 75 cents.
Yeah.
And so I think it was just this funny little idea of like, well, what if we just put on our own high-end Broadway show just so that we could sell Skittles for normal price? And so that little sort of kernel of an idea became our Super Bowl idea, which...
And how long was the actual piece that you finally did, edited down, and how long was it?
So the play, it was a live play. It was at the Townhouse or the Town Hall Theater on Broadway in New York.
And we got Michael
C. Hall from Dexter fame was the star of it. He's also
very close friends. If you're not in New York, you don't know what an amazing stage artist he is.
He's spectacular. And the play itself was about an hour long. It contained four full-blown, you know, original songs with choreography and a storyline. And, you know, essentially the plot of the play was Michael C. Hall, the actor, was afraid that his career was going to tank because he had just signed up to star in a Skittles commercial. Yeah. And so it was hyper meta. It was very, very on brand with what Skittles does. You know, there was a song, sort of the marquee song was called Advertising Ruins Everything. And it was so much fun. We worked with a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright to do the book, and, you know, a Broadway veteran to do the compositions. And we made a music video for Advertising Ruins Everything. We, you know, I produced the official cast album, which was on Spotify. We put out a vinyl record, and, you know, we put tickets on sale. All of the proceeds went to, you know, various charities and things like that. And we put the tickets on sale and the thing sold out, I believe, within a day. And that's a, you know, couple thousand person venue.
I mean, is this genius? Rose, you're a fan of Broadway. You know, you've worked on it, you've been there, you live and breathe it. How genius is this idea? Is anything?
No, it's absolutely genius. And also, I mean, the sad part about Broadway is that the majority of the country never gets to see, you know, what experience this is about that. Or even experience Broadway and, you know, expanding that. And having someone like Michael who, I mean, it's just like when Michael did Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Amazing.
When I was, I went backstage after, because we were going to go out after the show, and I said, shit, you know, because I had seen everybody who'd ever done that show, including, you know, all the iterations and the latest version of it. And Michael blew them all away. I mean, Neil Patrick Harris and, you know, like everybody that was doing it. Mm-hmm. Michael's version of that show was so much better than everybody else. And, you know, and then he went on to do, you know, the David Bowie piece right when it was like the last thing that Bowie did before he died. And, you know, this is Michael. Michael has his own band. And, but if you don't go to theater, you never know that about some actors, you know. We see actors on television and stuff, and we don't know that they started in Broadway or they're part of the theater world. So this is brilliant, Alex.
It was a crash course for all of us. I think, you know, I have memories of us, you know, selling in the idea to the clients and then, you know, hanging up the phone and everybody at the agency looking around and being like, wait, do any of us know how to do this thing that we just sold in? Like, I think me being the person in the agency with music in his title, I think that the thinking was that I was going to be the one to figure it out. And I was like, I have no earthly idea how to produce a Broadway musical. We're just going to have to figure this out together. But it was an absolute success. One of the coolest parts was that on the day of the Super Bowl, on the day that the show happened, we had resale tickets going for higher fees than Super Bowl resale tickets.
Wow.
And it was like for our little rinky dink commercial. And that was, such a similar to the Prince thing. That was such a sort of prescient moment of like, man, this thing that I get to be a part of,
Alex.
You know, all of the walls have sort of come down and we get to infiltrate culture in such interesting ways. And, you know, what we did, it was listed by Forbes and I believe a couple other major outlets as the best Super Bowl commercial. And it wasn't even a commercial and it wasn't, and it certainly didn't air during the game. And so it's a real treat and pleasure to have been a part of things like that. Which,
Alec,
just,
when you do something like that, does Super Bowl have to be part of? I mean, is there a license issue involved?
You're not allowed to use the word Super Bowl, so you have to get cute and clever with the language and refer to it as the big game or things like that.
Right.
And that's part of the joke, you know. The lyrics that we were writing and of the script that we wrote of, you know, we can't actually say the thing that we all know is the reason that we're here.
Brilliant. Congratulations, Alec.
You've had so many big moments in your career with some pretty epic songs being placed. What's been one of your favorite campaigns so far and what made it so special?
So one that I look back on with real fondness, and it's sort of in line with a lot of the things that we've talked about, was we did a campaign for the U.S. Army. The agency did eventually win that account. And we were tasked as an agency, you know, the U.S. Army, I didn't know this. The U.S. Army is literally older than the country that it defends. We had an army before we had a country. And so it is, you know, literally an age old institution, and we were facing a tough challenge of how do you speak to a new generation who maybe have sort of made up their minds as to you know, who the U.S. Army is, who it attracts, what they're meant to do, and speak to them in a way that's engaging and compelling, and, you know, has an entirely new generation of folks sort of lean into the conversation, and do that in a way that doesn't alienate, you know, an existing, you know, base of, you know, of people who are massive supporters.
I can't even imagine how this pitch went down. It's like, it's, you know, this 27-year-old something or another Chicago musician coming in and telling me how to run my army.
Right. Oh my God. That, I mean,
again, seriously. The beanbags, my friend. Jesus, you're so brave.
Yeah, it's, you know, it was like, and what, how do you possibly speak to, you know, the, you know, the 19-year-old city kid who wears Yeezys and AirPods and is on, you know, and is on Twitch, you know, and also
the lifeblood for them. Yeah.
And also speak to people who have, you know, who have had the U.S. Army run through their family for generations. And so it was interesting. So this was our campaign launch. This is our brand launch. You know, I had the task of figuring out how do we communicate all of this very complex messaging through music. And, you know, it took a lot of sort of taking a step back and really trying to understand what the overarching strategy was. And what it really boiled down to, I was able to kind of boil it down to kind of a sentence. And it was really what we were trying to accomplish was, you think you know the U.S. Army, but... And what we were hoping to accomplish was everything that came after that. Nice. Here it is in an entirely new, here it is in a new light. Here it is in a way that maybe you haven't thought about or seen before. Here is, you know, the incredible, remarkable diversity of the Army, not just in terms of the kinds of people that it recruits, but also what is needed for the U.S. Army. The Army needs bioengineers. The Army needs helicopter pilots. The Army needs, you know, drummers and chefs and, you know, whatever. Like, the idea was, whatever your calling is, you know, there's probably something here for you. And you
changed the way they do advertising, you know, to this day, it's that approach. It's amazing. Oh my God.
Yeah. And so it's been a real thrill to work on, you know, because I really do align with that messaging. And I think that there's something really valuable in it. And so in terms of music, you know, I had sort of crystallized what that strategy was. And I really just took some time to think, all right, how do you accomplish that musically? And, you know, there was this sort of light bulb moment that went off where it was like, oh, that's a remix. That's what a remix does. A remix at its best is, you think you know, X famous song, but here it is in an entirely new context. Here it is in the hands of somebody who is from a totally different genre of music, different place in the world, whatever it is, taking this thing that you think you know and putting it, shining it, you know, in a different light. And so I got really excited by the idea of the remix being sort of our strategic way in. And then it was really about figuring out, okay, well, what are we remixing? I really have to credit a really brave and excited creative team, because I think when you think of the U.S. Army and you think of something like this, at least my brain sort of instinctually goes to, you know, what I would call like the hockey stadium or soccer stadium anthems of the world. It goes to your Led Zeppelins, your Black Sabbaths, your AC/DCs, your White Stripes, you know, all of those. And I think the creative team was interested in doing something different and surprising people. And so the idea became, you know, what are styles of music or specific songs that have that level of hookiness, that catchiness, the something with amazing rips, you know, that musically you can sing along, you can see a big, big group of people, you know, chanting along to. But it isn't one of those ones that sort of you think of instinctually. And so, you know, we started to go down different wormholes, and it turned out that there were all of these, you know, Motown or Motown inspired songs that were doing this in spades. And, you know, one song that kept coming back up again and again and again was 25 or 6 to 4 by Chicago. You know, we were really in love with the horn section in particular of that song. And really drawn to the idea of like the electric guitar distortion pedal in so many ways was designed to embody the sound of a horn section. And so we were kind of reverse engineering, you know, some of the kind of classic rock stadium anthems and going back to the source a little bit. And we tried a number of different ways in. We worked with this wonderful original music company, you know, called The Elements, who are extremely, extremely proficient at this sort of thing. They're a great company based out of LA. And they created a remix for us that sounded so entirely fresh and new and progressive and exciting and bold and all the things that we were looking for while still utilizing the original master recording. And, you know, I had been in contact with, you know, Chicago and their people, and the band was very, very eager in some way connect with a new audience and to reach an entirely new generation. And this seemed like a really exciting way to do it. And, you know, they were, I think, sort of rightfully so, largely on the fence until they actually heard and saw this thing that we were creating. And I think what we made, you know, was just sort of, it was so different and it was so surprising. And it felt really just sort of authentic and right and bold in all of the right ways. And they were thrilled about it. And, you know, if COVID hadn't happened, my understanding was that they were going to use this remix that we made as their walkout music on their, you know, global tour.
I mean, what an absolute thrill that must have been for you. I mean, to not only be satisfying your clients, but, you know, to be able to know that the artist behind the song appreciates your work. I mean, Alec, we're running short on time. Colin has one last question I got to let him ask.
But yeah.
I just have to say, you know, as a music supervisor, I'm a fan, man. I really think what you're doing is changing the course of our business and just so exciting. You know, I'm just so thrilled to have you today.
Thank you.
I'm a fan.
Yeah. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Amazing.
Listen, Alec, I wanted to sort of ask you a little bit. We know that you've got a new album coming out. Have you set a date?
Yes. As of now, it is scheduled for April 15th. That is, until I decide last minute to change it, that's when the record will be coming.
Great stuff. How is it different from your past writing?
So this is the first record that I've made where I have decided to cede all vocal duties to other people. I've tried being a singer-songwriter. It's not necessarily my forte. And I realized, you know, over the course of the last couple of years, particularly in working with a bunch of other artists and producing and co-writing and recording on other people's work, what my strengths were, you know, what I feel I can sort of uniquely add to the conversation. And there was something that I was really compelled by. This record's been made over the last couple of years, and the world around us has gone through so many sort of dramatic, you know, social changes over the last couple of years. And I've been really excited about the idea of, you know, passing the microphone and doing what I do to create, you know, sort of a sonic bed for people that I deem to be sort of essential storytellers to tell stories over and to speak their truth over. And so the idea for this record was sort of the brief to myself a little bit was, can you make a piece of music, cohesive piece of art that says more than I've ever said before, but without the listener ever actually hearing my voice? And so whether it's through, you know, an instrumental or, you know, having a piece of music that includes, you know, a piece of spoken word over it or, you know, a sampled speech or whatever it is. The hope is that each song in some way tells a story, communicates a feeling, says something, whether it's just through music or through truly, truly brilliant artists that I've been able to rope into participating on this project. And it's been absolutely remarkably fulfilling project to have worked on. It's something I've been tinkering on and messing with for a number of years, and I can't wait for it to be out in the world and then sort of see how it connects.
Fantastic. Well, I think that we're all super excited to hear it, and especially on one of the Sunday listening sessions. Listen, Alec, I just want to say thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been absolutely fantastic. It's been fascinating to listen to you and to hear about your career.
So much fun.
Yeah, it's been incredible. And we're really excited, like I said, to hear the album. We can't wait to listen to it.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Jace.
Hey, Jason. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Just buried in paperwork.
Oh, for the sync report.
Not this time. Move me no mountain.
That indie film your music supervising?
Yeah.
Sounds like a great project. What's the problem?
It's a brilliant film and we're building a great soundtrack, but you can't imagine how much paperwork I deal with for these films.
Have you heard of Sync Lodge?
First, you got to draft up the sync request forms.
I've heard of Sync Lodge.
Then drafting and issuing contracts.
Yep, Sync Lodge is great, Paula. Does everything a music supervisor needs.
Then deliver the cue sheet. It never ends.
Doesn't Sync Lodge do all of that automatically?
Sweat Lodge? What are you guys banging on about? I got real issues I'm sharing with you guys.
Yeah, lots of issues.
We're trying to tell you, Jason. Sync Lodge is a new platform for music supervisors. It helps you to source the music, sync songs against scenes, draft up sync requests, and even creates the cue sheets once you've locked in the music to the film.
Oh, Sync Lodge does all that?
It's true, Jason. I just started using it for the sync report. And it's not only saving time, but it's so easy to use. I'm actually enjoying the work.
You guys are the best. Sync Lodge sounds amazing and exactly what I need for music supervising. Why am I always the last one to hear about these things?
I've been telling you about Sync Lodge for weeks.
Don't feel bad, Edge, for not telling me sooner. I know you're busy. You're a good guy.
Paula, is my mic on? Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Edge.
Guys, what's the name of that program again?
Sync Lodge.
That is something to scream about. Yes, you too can be cool like Edge and use cutting edge technology to help you with your film and TV productions. No matter if you're a music supervisor, director, producer, editor, save time and increase proficiency with Sync Lodge.
I need to find a new gig.
Sync opportunities. Of course, Lisa, the superstar, making it happen. How are you doing today, Lisa?
I'm actually doing well, thank you. It's our first day without guests in quite a while. Since we moved here, we've had everybody that we don't normally see just has been coming up to visit.
Yeah, so, that's nice.
Yeah, it's really nice to see everybody. But yeah, today's our first day without visitors.
Yeah, it's right nice now. To have some peace and quiet too. So it is very, yeah. You got to have the yin and the yang.
Yeah.
Jody, how are you feeling?
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. How's everybody else?
Everybody, I'm good. Let's see how everyone else is doing. Paula, welcome.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, really good. I'm still on a slight high from my long holiday. Or
man,
vacation.
How long was that? Were you like 3 months? What was it 4 months?
If only 3.5 weeks, but I'll tell you, it felt like 3 months because it was exhausting, quite frankly. I can't wait to come to Dublin for a break.
Oh man, that was a long holiday, 3.5 weeks.
Yeah, but you know,
over in America, we'd be clawing at the trees, you know, ready to get back in.
Yeah, well, I didn't really stop working, so. It was a holiday. It was away from home. But, you know, when you're a parent, as you know, Kevin,
yes.
A holiday is not a holiday. It's just a change of scenery.
Yo.
You've got a parent.
Chasing after the kids. Vinks, how you doing, my brother?
Oh, yeah, man. Succulent. Delicious. Fed and happy.
Oh, man. That's the way to be.
You know, I'm in that same room with Phil. All is good.
Phil now just jumped up.
Now the party officially begins.
It does. Phil came just in time.
Hello, everybody. Hey, how's everyone doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I've just been doing some very in-depth dramedy music, which is hilarious. It's just funny. It just makes me smile to do it. I'm in good spirits tonight. Ready for it. Ready for it.
You recently had a gig, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, well, tell us about that. What was that all about?
Well, I've had several just lately, but I'm always gigging with a band. Is that what you mean? That
with the band, gig, yeah. The gig with the band, that's what I meant, yeah.
Okay, I didn't know if you meant a placement gig or a gig with the band.
No, nope, the gig with the band.
The gig with the band. Well, I work with several different bands, and sometimes it's a big six- or seven-piece band, party band, Tamla Motown sort of band. We do called Red Hot and Blue. We do a lot of corporate functions. And I have a trio called Where's Frank, where I play my foot drums with my feet. And then we have another band called the John Notes Experience, which is a bit of a play on the Jimi Hendrix Experience, which I've done for over 30 years, that band. So,
oh wow,
as I work with, it's just, it's like a comfy old pair of slippers, you know, it's just great. You can just relax and let your hair down. So I've been doing quite a bit of that just lately. Yeah, it's been great fun.
Yeah, the one that I saw was in this great location. It's pretty amazing. That was sometime at some point.
Oh, yeah, that was just recently. Yeah, that was in this old barn. Which is very popular here in the UK, that a lot of old buildings are done out for weddings. This was a wedding we were playing at. We don't do many weddings these days, but it was an old friend of the family, so that's why we were doing that one.
Yeah, in a barn. That had to be fun.
Yeah, they just do them up, you know, and dress them all really beautifully. But they're proper, you know, booked venues, so people sort of...
Yeah, I'm going to gig tonight. I think I'll do a little bit of a rap. I'll do it. Mike MC today, just to show off a little skills.
Yeah, do it. Do it now. Do it
now. Yes, do it.
Binks will lay down.
I want to hear Cool Kevin do some rapping.
I got to get the beat first. Hold on. I got to let it get in me first. Yeah, let's get everything cranking, get the blood flowing, and then I'll spit a couple of verses. Lisa, so do we have something to jump into first, Paula? Can we have a little shout?
We do. We are going to be listening to pop song submissions first. And the first song we're listening to is Confession by Alexandra Christ and Chu the Producer. Play it, Milfredo.
Confession, you're on my mind. Yeah, I gotta confess.
That was me. Yeah, so I enjoyed that tune. We're going to give the baton to Phil. And of course, as always, Vinks. So, Vinks, are you ready for us? He is ready. Zididida.
Zididida. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Well, it was definitely a pop tune. You know, we all can always decorate the bed all kind of different ways, but in the end, it's still the bed. It's just what you want to use it for, what you want to decorate it as. You want to put some edge on it, if you want to put a little more funk under it, if you want to put some softness and some, you know, some ABBA on the top. It depends what you want to do with it. But the song itself, the bed is solid. And it's there, and it just depends what you want to do with it to express yourself as an artist. But the bones is great.
Okay. That was a confession. That's a nice confession there. Phil, what is your confession on this song?
Yeah, I've got a few confessions of my own, but I'll save it for another night.
Hey, we're not going to go there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're gonna take it to the sewer.
I thought it was very syncable, actually. I thought it was really catchy. It stayed with me. The chorus, I think, is very strong. Could see it in maybe an advert for a perfume or something like that. That's where it took me, you know, on a journey out to Adland. So I think it has a singable quality to it, the chorus. And the voices worked really well. I liked it. I enjoyed it. That's about what I can say about it, really.
That's enough.
Thanks. Thank you.
That's a good confession there. And this is what we're going to do here. Alexandra, I really, really enjoyed that tune. It definitely has a popability to it. But before I give my thoughts, I want to hear a little bit more about the song.
Hi, thanks for having me, you guys. I'm really honored to be here. My Chu actually submitted for the show. I was like, what did you submit for? Because I have a ton of pop stuff. But this song just came to me one day. I was walking down the street, literally, and I was like, man, I got a confession. Like, I was totally digging it. And then,
well, I want to hear the confession.
Well, it was about my darling.
Okay.
And but I write mostly for my goal is for ads and sync as well. But I really want to get ads. So I was like, imagine someone biting into a Dove bar, and imagine somebody driving their car, and then they're like touching the steering wheel. I've got a confession. You're my obsession, and you know. So I just started thinking of all the possibilities of this hook, and then I just called Chu and said, hey, I've got the hook. I've got lyrics. Do you want to write with me? And that's how it came to be. So there you go.
Yeah. So the popability of that song works for the syncability for our show. So
yahoo! Can I get celebrate? Woohoo!
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Heck yeah, Mom!
So the thing is, we don't know for sure. We're going to put it in the bag and then we're going to shake it up. And then as we do the episodes, that's when we start to plug in the music. So we are putting it in that bag that we're going to shake up. And then as we're writing the show right now. So we just finished writing the Christmas special.
And so
we're going to dive into some of the other episodes. And so as we're writing, as we're doing the animation and we're thinking about what goes where, then your song will be in that bag. So thank you very much.
Blessings on a Sunday, you guys. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Let's go ahead and move into Move Me No Mountain.
The brief itself is, homeless Jenna Anderson has given up on life and walks into the desert at night, only to stumble across a surreal Burning Man-style desert rave in the foothills of the mountains that surround Las Vegas.
Do we have anyone from Move Me No Mountain here?
We don't, sadly, I'm afraid.
Okay, so we can field it. We're filmmakers, we're musicians. We are well-versed in sync. So do we have a song ready?
We do.
Okay.
We are going to listen to Eternal Wheel by Rebecca Trujillo Vest. Spin it, Wilfredo.
Circling on time.
Man, I really liked that song. For me, it fits more in our pop, in our pop category for today. So, you know, this is a little aside. I'd like to put that in the bag for our pop songs. It really is catchy. That's a catchy tune. I can still hear the chorus going round and round in my head, to be honest. But before I give further thoughts on it, let's see what you have to say, Vinks.
For me, I loved it because, you know, the didgeridoo, of course, takes me back to like some event in Alice Springs in the middle and, you know, yeah, next to the rock. So I liked it. I actually liked the use of original, you know, Aboriginal instruments as well, and took it to another place. Round and round it goes. I mean, it's a kaleidoscope of visions that go with that. So it depends on the chef. What are you going to do with these spices? But you got some beautiful spices at your disposal in your pantry. So good luck.
Yeah, absolutely. Phil, before I pinion on the song any further, let's hear your opinion.
Yeah, same here, same as Vinks. I really enjoyed it. As soon as I heard the didgeridoo, I thought, ah, we're in here. That's great. I must admit, I did want it to relax a little bit in the track. The didgeridoo is just solid throughout. I would have been nice just to have a break for it from a production side. And I would have much preferred to hear the vocals up a bit and the didgeridoo down a little. But the track, I really enjoyed. It was a very, very relaxing track to listen to and enjoy. But, you know, it's a bit like the bagpipes. You like them for a bit, you know, but if it's in for an entire track, you know, it's just too much. So that was too much didgeridoo for me. I never thought I'd hear myself say that. I love the instrument. It has such a great vocal quality to it, the didgeridoo. I think when it's in beside a vocal, they can compete sometimes. That's just my opinion on it. But hopefully, Rebecca, you know, you can do something with that perhaps in the future.
So when you mix that, Phil, you're going to duck it in and out where you want it. So I think the potential is all there. You know,
you're right, Matt. Yeah.
Place it where you're going to place it.
Yeah. And Phil, absolutely. That's a really good suggestion. And especially considering you're a music coordinator for the show itself. So let's hear from Rebecca. Can you tell us a little bit about the song, Rebecca?
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for your feedback, everyone. Kevin, yes. Binks, and Phil. Yes, I hear you, Phil, because the didgeridoo does go through. I play the didgeridoo as well, but I had one of my best friends play it on this track. And I played guitar, and then I had a really cool other guitarist doing the arpeggio part. And John Exvalatis helped with that song. And I did this is my first album. I went traveling around the world and I was just noticing the cycles of humanity in life. And that's the round and round we go. And
That's deep.
And so that, you know, it was really inspired by just the whole across the board trippiness of life. So here we go again. We're circling all around, you know. And we end up kind of sometimes back where we started.
Yeah, wow. You know, I could kind of, well, I don't know about ending up where we started, but I could feel that journey in the song. And actually, I felt a little outer space in that too, to be honest. And, you know, that's what made me think about our show, the Sync Report. So with that being said, thank you so much, Rebecca. So let's check in for the next song. Paula, do we have something queued up?
We sure do. We are going to listen to Tribal Fire by David Kowal. Play it, Milfredo.
Thank you.
Well, that was short and sweet. Okay. I'm not sure if I felt like I was walking on the sands and into another music place. Maybe I felt more like I was in the catacombs, in the tombs, kind of trying to find my way through the copies and stuff like that. But let's hear what Vinks has to say about that one.
Dude, you know that is the perfect song for the anthem for a prenup discussion.
Is that it? You gotta leave it at that?
You know, when they're like, what do you mean? You love me. I don't need a prenup. No, you need a prenup. What? No, I don't want no prenup. Either you love me or you don't. But let me play with this song. Listen to the song and you'll understand that sometimes you don't know what the hell's going to happen. I just need to be ready for it.
Oh, yeah, okay. That makes sense. Right. I can go with that. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of took it a lot of different places. Yeah, that's right. Okay, before we get into the other all those places, Phil, can you give us?
That's so funny. I mean, that was a schizophrenic track. I mean, it was chaos, but I loved this style. It was brilliant, sort of bonkers chaos, which I enjoyed. Quite interesting, but I wanted to hear it turn into something else. So maybe you can tell us a bit about it, David. As mentions were with the track. Hey, David, how you doing?
Good. I'm doing great. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to the track. This is what happens after you spend 10 hours driving to Pittsburgh and you write it in a hotel room.
Gotcha.
So I saw the brief and it's like, well, I think I could put something together. So I had my gear with me and just put this together literally in about 20 minutes or so. I had seen the video of it. And so just remembering what I saw, the video of the fire scene, it just seemed like that might work. It just seemed to be a lot of chaos going on in the fire scene and whatnot. If I were to, you know, venture further, I certainly would turn it into something a little bit more musical. I think you're right about that. And, you know, that's kind of all I have to say about it. Just figured I'd submit it and see if it fit into that scene. And if you were interested, I can certainly, my ears tell me now it definitely needs a remix. You kind of want to put a little space in between creation and mixing, but thanks for listening. Appreciate it.
Yeah. David, yeah. So you've been with us for a while, right? You come.
Yeah, I'm enjoying every one of these. It's fantastic. And you've played a bunch of my stuff. I really appreciate that too.
Certainly we want to put that in a slot, a chaos slot. Maybe we're going through, you know, light speed or going through a black hole or something like that. A meteor shower or something. I don't know. But yeah, I enjoyed the song. Thanks for submitting, David, and all the music that you've submitted so far. And thanks for riding on this journey with us.
I appreciate it. I'm loving the journey. You guys are great.
Nah, man. I'm verklempt. I have to give a shout out to my brother from another mother, Jason. I am your guest host, Kevin, but Jason, who is your regular host, allowed me for 2 weeks in a row to spice you guys with a little bit of my vibes. Shout out to Jason. I'm not going to do the Jason invitation this time either. I promise I'll do it the next time. I already gave too much for this episode. But I have to give it up for my team. Jody Lynn, always giving it. Lisa, of course, and Paula, the three of them. I already gave them a song dedication. We might have to play it again next week. Vinks always coming with the sexy vibes. Phil, sexy vibes too. Thank you all. And our show is coming soon, The Sync Report. So stay tuned for that. And thank you all for being on this journey with us.
And thanks to Heather and Milfredo. We miss you. And Heather's usually helping with the music. We definitely miss you, Heather.
Yeah, I think she's on a plane right now.
She's on a plane back from Iceland.
Yes.
So, yeah.
We have to do an episode of the show from Iceland for sure. It's a place I've always wanted to go. Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, John Boy.
Listen, thank you so much, Alex Stern, for joining us on today's show. And to you, our listeners, for spending your time with us. The Sync Report cast will be back in a week with your hosts, Rose Ganguza, Jason P. Rothberg, and myself, Colin O'Donoghue. Until next time, take care and be kind.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.
Today's episode was produced by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Paula Flack, and Robert Capadonna. It was written by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Lisa Dunn, and Paula Flack. Editing was by Jason P. Rothberg, Milfredo Seven, Paula Flack, Edgar Edge Kamei, and Adam McNamara. Research by Lisa Dunn. Graphic design by Jody Lynn Talevi. Brought to you by Zavatar.